Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, April 28th. The increasingly erratic President Trump was back at the podium for another news conference last night after saying over the weekend that he was done with daily coronavirus briefings. That, of course, came after his embarrassing and dangerous musing on Thursday about injecting people with disinfectant. Listeners, I hope you at least got to see some of the comedy about that online, like the made-up advertisement for new Clorox chewables. Just to be clear, there is no such thing as Clorox chewables. You can die if you ingest any kind of Clorox. But the president gave a humor-hungry world a big fat opportunity to mock him even as they cringe. Princeton history professor Julian Zelizer is thinking about this year's presidential election as kind of like the ones in 1980 and 1932. In those elections, the incumbent presidents running for re-election were judged by the American people to simply be not up to the crises the country faced at that time. Jimmy Carter with the Iran hostage crisis, losing to Ronald Reagan, and Herbert Hoover with the Great Depression, losing to FBR. Now, that's not a prediction that President Trump will lose this year, but it is a historical comparison for what the central question of this election year is shaping up to be. In a CNN commentary posted this weekend, Zelizer writes, it might just be that the best thing Joe Biden can do right now is to lay low and let the president self-destruct. The more that Trump says about the crisis, the worse he looks, writes Julian Zelizer, Princeton University history and public affairs professor, a CNN political analyst, and a fellow at the progressive think tank New America. He joins us now. He's also, by the way, recommending Biden choose Elizabeth Warren as his running mate in a recent column. We'll talk about that, too. Hi, Professor Zelizer. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And let me play two contrasting clips that go beyond the disinfectant bomb, and by bomb I mean that in the showbiz sense, and point to the ongoing disconnect between Trump's rhetoric and reality, maybe in the most relevant way for the federal government. Here is his lead science advisor on the virus, Dr. Deborah Birx, on NBC's Meet the Press about testing on Sunday.
We have to have a breakthrough innovation in testing. We have to be able to detect antigen rather than constantly trying to detect the actual live virus or the viral particles itself, and to really move into antigen testing. And I know corporations and diagnostics are working on that now. We have to have a breakthrough. This RNA testing will carry us certainly through the spring and summer, but we need to have a huge technology breakthrough, and we're working on that at the same time.
So Dr. Birx says we need to have a huge technology breakthrough to have any hope of having enough testing. But here's the president at his news conference yesterday.
The United States has now conducted more than 5.4 million tests, nearly double the number tested in any other country, more than twice as much as any other country. Think of that.
Think of that. And that's where he leaves it. And he says that every single day. So, Professor Zelizer, as a political analyst, do you think much of the American public does not see that disconnect, that daily, I'll call it lying with misleading statistics?
I think they do. I think we're seeing in polling, whether it's President Trump's pretty low approval ratings or falling approval ratings, or whether it's the polls showing how well Biden is doing in many key states, I think the public does have a sense of the disinformation, of the inconsistencies, of the missteps that characterize almost every day of President Trump's response to this pandemic. And, you know, some worry if you're an opponent of President Trump that everything he does is somehow magical. But I don't think that's what the polls reflect right now. So I do think at some level it's catching on. The content of these daily pressers and the content of what he's doing is not adequate and not what a lot of the public is hoping for.
You can't get in the president's head, but do you ever wonder if he's at all embarrassed?
I don't know, and it's not an emotion he seems to display very often. He's more defensive than embarrassed, meaning he has a certainty that he's right, but he gets angry when people don't think so. At some level, he must be frustrated, though. I do think there's part of him that wants to be popular, that wants the public to see why, in his mind, he's so great, and that's just not what's happening. And this is an epic failure of leadership. That's what we're facing right now, and it's hard to deny that. So at some level, I don't know if he's embarrassed about it, but he's certainly not happy that's the position he's in.
Then again, the poll numbers only seem to go down within his range, right? So he's at...
Yeah.
Sort of the low end of his range, but that floor is always around 40%. And that's how he won in 2016. He just kept playing to that base and playing to that base and discrediting Hillary Clinton and discrediting Hillary Clinton. And he seems to think that this is still the path to victory, whether or not it's the path to serving the American people.
That is absolutely right. There he is totally consistent. This is his strategy. Keep the base happy and hope that the base plus the Republican Party generally comes out to vote in November. And it's unclear how the rest of the Republican Party will feel come Election Day. And it's unclear what Election Day is even going to look like. But this is the president's strategy, and that's absolutely accurate. The floor is low, but the floor is stable, and it doesn't move even in the middle of all this. And now that there are reopenings taking place in some of the base states of the president, I expect that that base will remain pretty solid.
And yet, your most recent commentary is that Biden should lay low. Since you can't beat something with nothing, I imagine... To take your 1932 and 1980 comparisons, I imagine Ronald Reagan and FDR weren't self-isolating in a house while they were running against the incumbents. Why do you just say Biden should lay low?
Well, I agree with that, and I've written pieces that over time, Biden is going to have to figure out how to run a campaign in this environment where he's not going to have rallies, where he's not going to have as much TV coverage, and they'll have to figure out a communication strategy. But right now, this is an election that will be defined about President Trump, and not only are conditions bad for this country and probably getting worse economically, socially, as well as health-wise, but on a daily basis, the president provides Democrats with fodder. He almost provides them with an ad during each presser about what's wrong with leadership. And right now, I don't think there's an urgent need for Biden to be out front on these issues, because I think it is a question about what President Trump is doing. And again, while the base loves him, a lot of the country doesn't. And that's not a great position for an incumbent party to be in.
And you wrote that along similar lines, the 2020 election being about Trump is why it shouldn't be surprising to hear progressives such as AOC, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, making it clear that they will support the Biden ticket regardless of their policy differences. You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, this was a fear, obviously, during the primaries of what would happen with the progressive base of the party. A, would they ultimately support Biden? And B, would they come out to vote? And that's a whole separate issue we can talk about in terms of what voting will look like. But you see many progressives, her and others, including Sanders, are saying they support Biden, they support the ticket. And I think that's not that much of a surprise. It's not just because of the pandemic. I think the animosity toward President Trump, the fear of a two-term Trump presidency is so grand that the differences over the Green New Deal or Medicare for All, while very important, are going to fade in the calculations of most Democrats. The one thing they will be voting on is, do you want four more years of President Trump? And many will answer that question, no, they'd rather have the alternative.
It didn't work in 2004 when Democrats were having their hair on fire because of George Bush and the Iraq War and torture and those things that were coming out at that time. We'll see if it works in 2020. I want to get to your article, and this is a little bit older, but it's only a couple of weeks, I think, at the most. So tell me if you're still on the Elizabeth Warren for vice president bandwagon.
Well, I laid out a case for her. It wasn't an endorsement, but I saw a lot of reason that she could be a very compelling candidate, even with the obvious cost that comes with picking a Democratic senator for the Democratic Party. I do think she could solidify those progressives, not only make sure they're on board, which I think they will be, but keep them energized, give them part of a ticket that excites them.
And what about the diversity issue? We saw the news in the last few days of Stacey Abrams saying she would be very interested in accepting the nomination. So I saw her interview on, I think it was CNN, on Sunday, you know, being very deferential to Biden and saying Biden has to, you know, take a lot of things into consideration and she'll support whatever decision he makes about a running mate. But there is the don't just pick a woman, pick a woman of color, both for political purposes, turnout, as well as for equity purposes.
I would say, look, I don't think that's an irrelevant consideration at all. It's an important one. I don't think Senator Warren, though, is just a woman. She brings immense expertise to the table. She, in a campaign that's going to be about governance and ideas, has provided voters already with an immense amount of material to work with. She exudes seriousness in a moment when the country is looking for leadership. And there is another issue that's very important, the security of middle-class families and the economic struggles they face. And there is not a single candidate, I would argue, that has dealt with this issue as much as her. And so the diversity concerns are important. I think there's a lot of candidates on the table that Biden can pick from, but she brings a lot, and it's more than her gender.
You know, since you wrote about Biden and we're talking about gender, I want to get your take on the 1990s sexual assault allegation that is rising in the news. This, for example, from Business Insider, which is not a conservative site, We now have more corroboration, they write, of the sexual assault allegation against then-Senator Biden in 1993. Their reporter Rick McHugh writes in Insider that a neighbor of Tara Reid, the former Biden staffer who recently filed a criminal complaint accusing him of assaulting her in a hallway, has come forward to corroborate her story. The neighbor, Linda LaCase, says Reid told her about the alleged incident in 1995 or 96, a few years after Reid says it occurred. LaCase said Reid shared with her many of the same details that Reid has recently alleged. LaCase says Reid did not ask her to come forward now. She adds that she is a Democrat and plans to vote for Biden. She says she came forward because she believes it was the right thing to do. It says a second corroborator, Lorraine Sanchez, was a colleague of Reid's in a California state senator's office after she left Washington, D.C. Sanchez says Reid told her her former boss in Washington had harassed her. Sanchez did not recall whether Reid went into detail. Biden's campaign has said Reid's allegation is false. Biden himself has not commented on it. Business Insider concludes he's going to have to. And also throw in the other recent days news on this, that there's Tara Reid's mother in the 1993 call-in to the Larry King TV show on CNN, which has now surfaced. She did not reveal her name or say what senator her daughter worked for or what exactly allegedly happened to her daughter. But if we believe Ms. Reid that that is her late mom on that tape, she did make a call to a TV show about behavior in Washington and say her daughter worked for a senator and had problems. So what do you make of all this in political terms, and how do you compare it to, let's say, the Brett Kavanaugh standard or the Al Franken standard, Professor Zelizer?
It's a serious accusation, and I do think not only do Democrats need to respond to this, and some have, but I do think Biden will have to say something. There are lots of inconsistencies in the story. There's been documented erratic behavior by her on a number of issues, and there's many holes in this if you were looking at it from a legal standpoint. But it's a very serious accusation, and now we have more support for her having talked about this in the past. So I don't think Biden can hide from it. I don't think it will be satisfactory ultimately if he doesn't come forward and say this didn't happen. And for sure, this will be maintained as a political issue by Republicans in the months to come. So he would do himself a favor if he showed why this wasn't true and made a claim of that sort. But I think this is pretty significant development in the last few days.
Pete in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pete.
Hi. The professor has it all wrong. The vice presidential choice has to be a minority or else the Democrats lose the race. It doesn't matter if it's Hispanic or African-American, but just look at the race from 2008 and 2012. They got many more minorities to vote than you did in 2016. They're going to lose if they don't put a minority on the ticket.
Pete, thank you. And, of course, that's not the only reason that Barack Obama got such turnout. But, Professor, what do you think of it as a political analyst?
No, I mean, look, it's a fair concern and it's a fair point. I'm not clear that inevitably the vice presidential pick, if it's not an African-American or a Latino, that would doom the candidacy. There's so much more at work in this particular election. And some candidates like Senator Warren might bring out other parts of the electorate, including younger voters, who will be very important on Election Day. And let's remember, we don't know what Election Day is going to look like. What we really might be talking about is absentee ballot voting and turnout in a moment when you have staggered days of voting or staggered hours of voting. So I don't think using 2008 and 2012 are quite as clear as they might seem. And President Trump, meaning President Trump, was not on the ticket. And that's going to change the dynamic. A lot of people are going to want to come out and vote if they can and vote in whatever way is possible because of the incumbent. And that's going to be more powerful than any single vice presidential pick in the end.
Katie on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Katie.
Okay, yes, I agreed with the professor. I'm sorry I didn't get his name. What?
Julian Zelizer from Princeton.
Hi. Anyway, hi. Yes, I agree 100% that Elizabeth Warren would be a really strong choice on the ticket because of all the things she brings to the party and her leadership and her in-depth and her, you know, she would be a really good backup person in the administration, for one thing, but I just think on the ticket, having a woman on the ticket would energize women. And Stacey Abrams, I would totally support also. I really think she would be a fine choice. But I think in terms of winning, I'm sorry to say, I just think that Elizabeth Warren would provide more balance to Biden's lack of articulateness, for example, and I mean, Stacey Abrams, quite good, too. But I just think Elizabeth Warren is a more known commodity to more people. She's been in the public eye. A lot of people were disappointed that she didn't go further and that she didn't end up, you know, as a presidential candidate. And it just, we need something that will really, I don't know. I think it would make, mm-hmm. I think we have a better chance if she's on the ticket.
Wilson in Bushwick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Wilson.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I'm thinking Stacey Abrams for vice president and Kamala Harris for attorney general. I love Elizabeth Warren. I definitely supported her in the primary, but I feel that with Biden president and her vice president, it's a very old ticket. Both of them will be over 70 years old. Can we get some younger blood in there? That's my thought.
Wilson, thank you so much. So, Professor Zelizer, how about that historical question regarding bringing along your state? Because we've been talking about diversity mostly in terms of race and gender, and that's what gets talked about a lot these days. But traditionally, the diversity that presidential tickets have been going for is geographical diversity, because they're looking at which swing state some candidate's running mate might be from and how likely they are to bring along that state, a la LBJ and Texas. Hard to imagine for people alive today that a Democrat won Texas in 1960, but that was 60 years ago, and the powerful and popular Senator Lyndon Johnson was the running mate. So how do you see that history? Is that the only really relevant example, and does it matter anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the great example of regional balance, and there's others going back back in time before the 1970s, and the only other one example since then, I do think Walter Mondale, who was Jimmy Carter's vice presidential pick, helped him shore up votes in traditional northern blue collar constituencies, but in general, that
Minnesota.
Doesn't happen. Right, and that's in 1976. Yeah. Generally, that doesn't happen. I'm one who thinks vice presidential picks tend not to matter very much. I think we're in an age where regional balance is not what you're looking for. It's unclear anyone can deliver a state. You're looking for different things. You're looking for a vice president who could compensate in the public mind for some of the shortfalls of the candidate who's running. You're looking for a candidate who might help energize very particular parts of the electorate, although that's unclear whether they can do that. I think in this time, in 2020, you're also looking for a candidate who can just help campaign in a period of a shutdown. And I think that's where Democrats really need to be thinking about which of the candidates will be able to reach out in social media, will have a communication skill that's very desired. But I doubt any of the candidates would be able to deliver a state personally to the Biden ticket.
And I just want to acknowledge, Professor Zelizer, that among the things that got canceled today because of the pandemic are primary day in New York State, where Bernie Sanders would have been on the ballot, even just to collect delegates now that he's conceded the race. That's not going to happen. They put off the primary until June, but only for local races. There's going to be no presidential primary in New York anymore. I can't remember that happening before. And the other thing that got canceled was the release of your new book, which was supposed to be today, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party. I see that's now scheduled for release in July, so consider this a public invitation to come back when the book actually comes out.
Accepted.
But you want to give us a soundbite on how much Newt Gingrich was Donald Trump before Donald Trump and picked up on something or created something that has driven us to this moment?
Absolutely. A Republican Party that has embraced full-throated, smash-mouth partisanship, where every institution and norm can be torn down in pursuit of partisan power. That really starts in the 1980s. Newt Gingrich is really the architect of that whole strategy for the GOP. The party guardians open the doors, and I think, you know, President Trump is very much a product of that world rather than the creator. So when the electorate thinks about what the parties are, it's not President Trump or the old Republican Party. The two are much closer than you think. And that's what my book is about, and I look forward to talking about it.
Julian Zelizer, thanks as always. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.